Colonel White, Reel 1. Could you tell me, first of all, where you were born, please?
I was born in Northern Ireland, in Belfast.
And which year was that?
It was 1913.
Could you give me the exact date?
Yes, the 20th of September.
1913.
That's right.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a manufacturing chemist. He had a degree, and before the war was responsible, the First World War, he was responsible for research under some of the leading pharmaceutical firms.
Whereabouts were you educated?
I was educated mainly in Northern Ireland, but in part in England.
Whereabouts?
In the south of England.
At which institution?
Well, it was a small school that is no longer running, unfortunately, called the Tower.
And when you finished your education, you went into medical practice?
No, I went into hospital work in London.
How did you come to be in the forces originally?
During my student days, I was a member of the Officers Training Corps. And when you were in the senior ranks of that, you were expected to do two certificates called Certificate A and B. And as a result of Certificate B, I was warned just before the war broke out in September that my services would be required, and I signified I was willing immediately to be called up, which I was.
What was your reaction to the outbreak of war?
I expected it. I knew it was coming. We all did at my age. We were in our, just beyond our middle 20s then. And those of us who had travelled in Europe a little saw what was going to happen.
Did you go into the Royal Army Medical Corps?
Yes. I was commissioned straight away. And the first 2 years of that was spent mostly in hospital work. I was doing surgery at the time.
In Britain?
Mostly in Britain, yes. However, I had volunteered to go overseas, and much to my desire, I found myself en route to India.
Which year was that?
That was in 1941. And arrived in India and went into hospital work, mostly, and life was very pleasant. This was towards the end of 41. Mere stress at night, games, riding. Some of the chaps were playing polo. And suddenly, on the 7th of December, the thunderbolt hit us. Pearl Harbor. And that was the end of the easy life.
What happened to you once Pearl Harbor occurred?
I volunteered for something more active and found myself in a newly raised organization called V-Force, V for Victory, which had been raised in a hurry because the enemy had hurried up through Singapore, which failed with the loss of 120,000 men, as you know, prisoners. They came up very quickly through Malaya into Burma and up through Burma to the Indo-Burmese border.
How did you first hear about V-Force?
The old tape line. I'm not quite certain who told me about it, but I was quite intrigued when I realized what this was. And when I joined it was a motley crew, polyglot. I fortunately could converse in both Hindi and Urdu, which was a great help, but it was, of course, Gurkhas, they speak Gurkhali, which I picked up fairly quickly because of the Urdu. There's a lot of similarity. And it wasn't organized at first. We were put together very rapidly. Armaments, medical supplies, the various things, the infrastructure had to be raised quickly.
Who had formed it? Who had formed it?
The commander, well, there were several people at headquarters. The name of the senior commander I'm not certain of at the moment, because I was never at headquarters. And of course it increased in size quite rapidly.
What was the objective of V-Force? What was it meant to do?
The object was to hold the enemy at the Burma Indian border, to prevent them getting into India.
Was it an irregular force?
Yes, it consisted of people who had been brought together. Some of them were what we called state troops. In fact, the state of Tripura. I was with them for some time, and I have to say how very good they were. They weren't regular army, but in many ways they were, well, I'd say they were extremely good.
They were the troops and of the Maharaja of Tripura.
The Maharaja, his palace was at Agartala, and his troops, we moved east, eventually down the Caledon Valley. We were now in Burma. Long lines of communication, of course, carrying everything with us. There was no air support.
When was this?
We were days, this is in 1942.
Do you remember the month?
By the time we reached our objective, it was December 42.
December?
December 42.
So it was the dry season?
It was, yes, we were beyond the monsoon. We'd gone through the monsoon, of course. I could tell you so much about that, the unpleasantness of the monsoon. 3 months incessant rain, mud, and what was to come later? Malaria. We all had malaria. It was 100%. We eventually got on to suppressive treatment, a thing called mepocrine. But hepatitis, pneumonia, gastroenteritis, jungle sores were one of the great hazards. If your condition wasn't of the best, slight cut, went septic, roaring sepsis, you could lose the limb. And evacuation was extremely difficult over open country with no lines of communication.
What was your own role in the V-Force? Were you in charge of all the medical side of V-Force?
No, because by the time I had got my side of it together, it had expanded. So that there were other medical officers coming in. But I was alone, and our setup was alone. And we'd no very little contact with headquarters.
What rank did you hold at the time?
I was a captain at that particular time.
And so you were responsible for the health of how many men?
Over 1,000.
About a battalion?
Of that strength. But a mixture of nationalities, of course. Including a Hisnerad, some good Scotsman.
Who was the commanding officer of this 1,000 men?
A man called Sawyer, Colonel Sawyer.
And what equipment did the force have in terms of weapons?
Very light. We had rifles, of course, bayonets. We had a few mortars, mostly 2-inch, which are very light, as you know, and very few automatic weapons. No Bren guns. We had no Bren guns at that stage.
And you started from Tripura?
Tripura, yes. That's in the really the southern part of Bengal, and the headquarters were at Agartala. And I can't speak highly enough of the Maharaja and his state troops.
What kind of route did you take into Burma, into the Kaladan Valley?
Oh, going due east. Going due east, right through the border between, well, it wasn't marked, of course, because it's very open country, and most of the marching was on foot track. There were no roads, no tarmac roads, and we had no animals, of course, with us, and certainly no transport of any sort. It is your hoofs. We carried our world on our back. And that was it.
Did you come across the local people much?
Very little. They avoided us.
When was the first time you ran into the Japanese?
Late 42. It would have been December.
Can you describe what happened when you first met them?
They were holding up pagoda on a hill. Most pagodas are. And we had to attack this pagoda and clear out the enemy with our very light armament. And knowing that casualties, there was no airlift, any casualties we would have to deal with ourselves. And we linked up with a contingent of the Baluch Regiment. They came in to reinforce, called Soot Call, after Colonel Souter. Colonel Souter was in charge of Soot Call, and they linked up with us. So we were now investing a Japanese stronghold.
Did it have any particular name?
It is on near a place called Sapung, S-A-P-U-N-G, Sapung.
How strong were the Japanese force there?
Several hundred. We had no means of knowing because we invested it.
Did the Japanese resist to the death?
To the death.
Were they all killed?
Some of them escaped one night. They escaped carrying some of the wounded with them. They managed to slip through us. But they never came back. We regarded this as an important local victory.
You were dealing with the casualties during the battle, right?
That's right.
Were there many of those?
Yes, of all types, because the fighting was in part hand-to-hand, bayonet, small arms, and mortar. That's all we had. It's all the Japanese had.
Did you deal with any Japanese casualties?
None. Not one.
Is Sapung in the Kaladan Valley?
It's near there, yes.
Were you lacking in any necessary medical supplies to deal with the casualties there?
We had to be extremely frugal in anything we did, because there was no reinforcement.
Could you give people anesthetics?
Intravenous, yes. But not by the airway.
So people who needed anesthetics got them?
I think I can say yes to that.
What happened after this investing of the pagoda?
That particular area was held by us. But further south in the Arakan itself and further east, there was a lot of fighting by the Allied forces, between the Allied forces and the Japanese, and the Japanese held firm. place called Bhuti Dong, Cox's Bazaar. They were not surrendered by the enemy. There was movement to and fro, the enemy be driven out, but they always managed to get back. And that takes us into the middle 42. We were then withdrawn. We came back to India on our flat feet. This is now 43, of course, mid 43. We were all full of malaria. And most of us, in fact, all of us were sent on leave.
What was the...
I went up to friends at Darjeeling, a very nice tea garden, 10,000 feet up. But every so often I broke down with malaria. And that lasted for quite a long time.
What was the morale in V Force Line?
High. And became more so as events progressed, because we knew we were doing the right thing, albeit the enemy hadn't given up the Arakan.
How long did it take you to get on your feet again in Darjeeling?
Looking back on it, off and on, it was a matter of several weeks. The precise days, but without being able to count back, just off the cuff, I wouldn't be able to say. I then came back and reported to my headquarters, medical headquarters, in India.
Where was that?
In India.
Whereabouts in India?
Near Delhi. And they said to me, I don't know how to put this in terms, shall we say, they said, you were looked upon with favor. And I said, what happens to me now? They said, what do you want to do? I said, I wish to go on with something similar. They said, well, there is something. In fact, have you heard of Wingate? And I said, yes. And I found myself lining up to go into Wingate Chintits.
What had you heard about Wingate at that time?
A very redoubtable character, a jungle leader, somebody who was very unusual, who called the tune when he faced the enemy. And I felt I would offer my services. I might be of help to him, at least of some use.
Where did you join the Chindits and when?
I joined the Chindits shortly after that, in mid-43. We went to a place called Sagar, central India. I came before Wingate, and I remembered all the things I'd been told about him. He was a very unusual character.
What happened at your meeting?
I felt I had to feel my way very carefully, because I felt I'd be out of place if I made any suggestions. One had to be sensitive to one's surroundings. Nevertheless, I think we made our point in that we wanted to do certain things. We were prepared to take over something responsible, whatever that meant. And he said, you're in, come back in the morning, which I did. And I was told I was a senior medical officer.
You told me earlier that he tried to stare you out.
Oh, yes. Well, if you want details, He laid down the law, small, very outgiving, unbending character, without a smile, with quite a biblical ease of quotation, which is quite genuine. And he did try to stir me out. It is difficult to say that he did, but he did try very hard. The next day when I went back, I got my orders to join the 101 Brigade, start training, which we did.
You also told me that he assumed that you were going to join when you met, and you rather put him right about that.
I had to make sure that he understood that I wanted to find out more about it. Yes, about the expedition. He'd already been in Burma with a smaller show, but now this is a really big thing. He was, he had Winston Churchill's ear, and the Allies were prepared to back him in association with air cover, and we hoped air evacuation. But it was called LRPG, Long Range Penetration Group, which meant going several hundred miles in behind the enemy and living there and cutting the heart out of the enemy center. Supplied by a five-day drop, the possibility of getting out some of our casualties, but obviously no guarantee, because the planes had to come in from their headquarters in India, find a landing strip in the jungle, and they were very light planes, they were called L1, and they could only take one passenger. And of course, if you had a badly wounded man, you had to remove all the splints and the stretcher, because he'd be wrapped around the pilot's waist.
When Wingate gave you this task, did you make any kind of demands about what you would require?
I didn't feel I was in a position to quite do that, but I did ask what the conditions were. And I was told, frankly, by this time I'd been passed over to the senior medical officer in charge. And the information was, we were in behind the enemy lines, we were on our own, there was no way out except by air, and that would be a very thin line indeed. The only communication would be by radio. And a five-day drop, of course. Airdrop.
How many medical assistants were you to have?
Six.
Did you choose them?
Six doctors. We started training. And one doctor after the next came to us. The training was quite strenuous. Not only physically, but psychologically. And we lost a lot of our otherwise excellent young doctors who would have done well, but they couldn't stand it. They had to give up. Eventually we had our quota. In fact, by then it was eight. The numbers of the LRPG group had increased. And we were only one brigade. There were other brigades now being raised by the Chindits. We were one of the other brigades. I was the SMO of this brigade, with the younger doctors under me. In fact, some of them were older than I was. When I say younger.
What number was your brigade?
111.
In what way were there psychological stresses in the training?
The knowledge of what you were being led into. You were going to be in your own surgeon, your own physician, your own dermatologist, everything medical that you could think of. your own eye surgeon, etc., etc., orthopedic. You're on your own. Nobody to help you, except your orderlies. And they were RAMC orderlies, simply. Most of them very good.
What was there in the way of medical equipment that you could take in with you?
The half side, one half side of a mule. All our mules were devocalized for obvious reasons. We had a number of ponies for the sick, but they didn't last very long. Once we were in Burma, their lives were all very short, sadly. The mule is a tough old creature, he can stand anything. But you're allowed a pannier on one side of the mule.
What would it contain in the way of medical supplies?
Dressings, instruments, all the instruments that were utilitarian, the various medicines in very limited numbers, Mepocrine being the most important because we're all on suppressive Mepocrine, and every man had to have one Mepocrine tablet a day once we were in Burma. I'm rather jumping ahead now from our training period, but that pannier was never large enough, of course. The doctor had to carry much of his own stuff in his own pack, which in any case weighed 70 pounds. We all carried 70 pound load, doctor or otherwise. And of course, once you're in the jungle, you had your carbine, you wouldn't move without it. The jungle's very unfriendly. The enemy sometimes are only a few feet from you at night. Everybody was armed.
Presumably no antibiotics at that time.
Sulfaguanidine had just come in. In fact, we had the first drop. Once we were in Burma, I had my first sulfaguanidine drop to me. First time I'd seen it.
Can you tell me about going into Burma?
Yes. I'll be brief about this. We moved from our training area by rail into Assam, where we did our final training. I hasten to add, when you say training in camp, there were no coverings of any sort. We never had tentage. Part of your training. You couldn't have tents. We were moving constantly. Sometimes in Burma you'd be moving 25 miles a day. And you couldn't have mosquito nets, of course. That was out. It would have been very unwise. Well, it just didn't arise. The other side of the dealing with casualties, those who were immobilized were dragged behind the